From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour was made on Saturday, March 8th at 12:41 a.m. in Kuala Lumpur. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 took off, bound for Beijing. It never got there, of course, vanishing from Malaysian civilian radar at 1:30 in the morning. And the search was on. Vietnam launched a search operation that expanded into a multinational hunt, starting in the South China Sea, but every lead turned out to be something other than the missing plane. After days and several weeks of hope, the Malaysian government announced that the plane had almost certainly crashed into the ocean. And with a space so large and wide, recovery has been a tremendous challenge. But technology brings some new hope. On Sunday, April 6th, Australia sent planes and boats to investigate a pulse signal that had been detected by a Chinese ship. The signal was the same frequency, they said, used by aircraft black boxes. If the battery of the Malaysian plane's black box was still functioning, it could be the brake that would lead teams to the lost airliner. Well, in the days that have followed, more signals, a couple of more, have been detected, but no airplane. Why is the search so complicated? We welcome your comments and questions, and we welcome Professor Duncan Moore from the University of Rochester. Professor Moore, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
We've been very careful in covering this story, and by now most of our listeners know that some network, CNN's been ravenous in their appetite for any new shred of information or gossip. We didn't want to go down that path, but we do want to explore the science, and Professor Moore, for our listeners, this is the ideal person to help us do that, a professor of optical engineering. You were confirmed by the U.S. Senate in the fall of 1997 for a position of Associate Director of Technology in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. In that position, for about 4 years, you advised the president, helped advise president on technology policy, you've been behind a number of initiatives there. So your background is extensive and impressive, and if anybody can help us understand what's going on, I would assume it's you. But I would also assume that you are not surprised that it's taken some time to try to find this plane. I mean, it took 73 years to find the Titanic. It's not right. We hope it's not going to take 73 years, but you're not surprised, are you, that it's taken this long?
No, not really. It's a very difficult problem because when you have the propagation of the sound in the water, people think it's very straightforward. That is, the sound propagates in a straight line out to the sources. In fact, that's not what happens. What happens is it propagates on a curved path. And in doing so, you're fooled as to where the actual source of the sound is. And so it's actually an area that I've done research in for over 40 years when I started my master's thesis at Rochester.
Has this issue come up in prior recovery efforts?
Not as far as I know. I don't know of anybody that's actually looked at this problem before.
And so as we talk about how deceived we can be, how far off course can it get here? How far can that travel or be, and I'm going to use some incorrect terms, and I apologize, but bent and reflected? How far can that move?
Oh, you could be off by hundreds of miles easily.
Hundreds of miles?
Yeah, you could be. And the problem is the following. It's everybody's seen this phenomenon, even though they don't know it. And the example of it is the mirage. If you're driving down the road on a hot summer's day, the road ahead of you appears to be wet. And what's happening there is the heat from the sun is heating up the road. So the road is getting hotter. The air above the road is getting hotter relative to the air, say, 10 feet off the ground. And so light, which would normally propagate in a straight line, that is, we see each other in this room mm-hmm. by light bouncing off, say, your forehead and going a straight line to my eye and vice versa. And so light is normally propagating in these straight lines. If I hold a candle between the two of us and I heat the air above us between, say, your face and my face, we'll see the image wavering. Mm-hmm. And that's why stars twinkle at night. It's because of that variation of the density of the air as it's moving in the atmosphere. In the case of the mirage, what's happening is light, which would normally go in a straight line, actually doesn't go in a straight line, but it starts up in the sky, say. It would normally go straight into the ground, but instead it comes along a curved path, hits, if you will, tangent or just skims the road surface and comes up to your eye. You can't tell how it got there. You only see, you perceive that it came from below the road surface, okay? But it could be up in the sky, you know, kilometers. And I'll just do a demonstration for you, and you can get to this on the website. And I'll tell the audience how to get this.
Okay. He's doing a demonstration now with some light through.
So
light through a piece of glass?
This is a piece of plastic.
Piece of plastic.
Okay, right. And so I've got a laser pointer, and we see that the laser beam is going straight through the bottom of this.
It is going straight through, yes.
Right, so now look what happens. As I move the pointer up, the beam bends down.
What an amazing demonstration.
And so, so if you go to, if the audience goes to www.rochester.edu homepage, there's a demonstration of that on the thing.
Rochester.edu to see the same demonstration he just gave me.
And then on that same website is we have it, now I'm sending it down, and it's coming back up. So this is the example of the mirage. So I'm representing this beam.
And the light even appeared to be dancing to me a little bit there.
Well, that's because I'm not holding it steady enough. operator error.
You're aiming the laser pointer on a downward trajectory.
Correct.
But as it passes through the plastic, it ends up higher than where you started it on the other side.
Correct.
And so here's the part when you think about the lost airliner. And again, we're talking to Professor Duncan Moore from the University of Rochester, a professor of optical engineering, about why this hunt for the lost airliner is so difficult. What you're showing me is a piece of plastic, what is that, 6 inches maybe?
It's four.
Four inches long. 4 inches long. Now let's imagine how many miles, how far down is the, they think roughly 3 miles.
Yeah, about 5 kilometers, 3 miles down.
About 3 miles down.
Correct.
What are the factors that are going to cause a pinging sound? And again, we're talking about a pinging sound, but how? First of all, actually, let's back up on the science here. How is that sound detected? It starts with the black box, and we think the battery lasts roughly a month, so the hope was that it would.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sends a signal, and it's detected where eventually?
They'll have what are called hydrophones. These are like microphones, like the microphone we're talking into, but they're designed specifically for working underwater. Mm-hmm. And they work at frequencies that are above the audio frequency that we can detect. We can detect up to about 20 kilohertz. And I've forgotten, these operate at, I think, higher than 30 kilohertz. And so they're putting out this signal continuously. And so what happens is, you know, I mean, we would think that, the sound's going in a straight line, or as I showed here,
yep.
And it's not doing that. It's going on these curved paths. And on the website, there's an example.
Rochester.edu.
Yeah, right. I pulled an example, which I'm showing you here, and you'll see these over in this point. This is great on radio.
That's okay here. He's showing a sort of a graphic image where you can see a number of wavy lines, and they are wildly divergent there.
And definitely not straight.
They're not straight lines at all. And so it can travel through the ocean water in any kind of manner here.
Exactly. And this assumes that there's no reflection from mountains that are below the world, below the surface of the water. So that'll bounce off those. And so you get all these very strange patterns that can exist. And one of the things I point out on the website is if you're located about, from this particular one, if you're located about 80 kilometers away from the source, about 50 miles away from the source, you can actually detect the signal. But as you get closer, you lose the signal.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Let's say you're directly over it.
If you're directly over it, that won't be a problem. This is a case where the source is way over here.
Oh, okay, I see. All right. So, but as you get, boy, there are times where you almost have to hit the right window to detect it. Now, do they know? And by the way, if you've got questions to help the host understand the science, jump in here. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. When it comes to those pinging sounds, are they certain it is the plane?
I think they're pretty certain now. I don't know what the percentage is, but it seems that the consensus is that is the case.
It is such a distinguishable detection that they know that that's got to be coming from the black box.
Well, they think it's got to be man-made.
Got to be man-made. Okay.
And so what else would be man-made that we're operating that frequency?
Okay, fair enough. So there's a strong suspicion that it is. But what they've begun doing now is, as I understand it, and reading numerous sources this morning, not just CNN, but what they're beginning to do is they send down, and I would love to pull up the name of this thing. It's a very interesting object that is supposed to go all the way down near the surface, kind of a drone, and it just sort of does a sweep, looking for objects, and then humans have to analyze the data that it sends back. I mean, we're talking about a humongous search area here. How, it feels rather hopeless to me when I think about it in those terms. What do you think?
Well, look how long it took to find the Air France plane. That was about 2 years it took them to find that. They had some pretty good ideas where it was.
And forgive me, was that off the coast of South America?
Yeah, that was from Brazil to Paris, I
right.
think.
It took how long to find that?
I think it was over 2 years.
Wow. Wow. And so now we're looking at potentially a long search, but you said even this morning, did you say that what you saw on CNN, is the science sometimes off from what you see reported in the media?
Yeah, it's really interesting. This morning on CNN, they had a commentator on talking about the propagation of the sound in the water. And he made the comment that if you're further away, the signal was going to be weaker. Well, this diagram shows that's not necessarily the case. You could have no signal and be closer to the source than that. And so it's a common misconception that things just go in the simple propagation.
You talked about the underwater topography, and we forget the fact that the ocean floor is not just a flat floor. And so topography could be an issue. What are the other factors that could move the signal and send it far off course?
Well, reflections. So you could get reflections off the interface between the air and the water, so coming up from the bottom, in the same way as you get reflection off glass, where you get the change of the composition causes there to be a reflection off, say, the glasses you're wearing or the window glass here. You could get reflections off the mountains. You could get absorption that would reduce the signal. So there's a lot of optical properties in there. Scattering, in the same way, imagine, you know, I put this laser beam into a glass of milk, and it starts scattering in all directions, so it reduces the signal but makes it go in all directions. So a lot of problems here.
Is there any scientific way to approximate just how that signal would be affected? I mean, it seems like there's too many variables to really get a good gauge on where it might be coming from.
I think that's a problem because we don't have a lot of information in a lot of parts of the deep water. I remember years ago when I was in Washington, we knew more about the surface of the moon than we did of the oceans. That we knew more about its topography than we did in the deep oceans, which is kind of a sad commentary, but it doesn't have the thrill of exploring the moon as it does the water. But it's probably a better use of resources to be more exploring the oceans.
I see the phone's ringing, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you have a question or a comment for Professor Duncan Moore from the University of Rochester, he's a professor of optical engineering. We're talking about 3 miles down. That is, I would assume, terribly inhospitable. And how difficult a condition is that?
Well, it's pretty cold, for one thing.
Yeah.
It's obviously near freezing for that thing. You've got a huge pressure column that is all the water above you. So that's why these submersibles, you know, can't go just anywhere.
What do you mean by pressure column?
Well, it's the amount of water above you. In the same way as you're doing diving, if people are used to doing diving, they know that as they get deeper, the pressure is getting greater. And so you think about all the water, the weight of the water above you. And so if you've got 3 miles of water above you, you just think, you calculate how much it weighs, and that's the pressure that's being developed on you, whatever's down there.
Let's get to the phones. Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, I appreciate this conversation, and I appreciate the technology and science that you're talking about. My question, though, is, was in fact the people that are looking this too insignificant, or enabled? For example, if they used a single microphone, would they have been better off using multiple microphones? Or one of my questions is, they've got this solar device that they're going to put down 3 miles. If they put the capability of the solar device down, would they have been able better to hear the actual monitor, or the actual sound noise coming from the recorder? Thanks for the show. Bye-bye.
So first of all, I think I'm not sure whether I heard it right, but it's a sonar, not solar, device. And the second thing is they don't use simply one microphone. What they use is an array of hydrophones, and they tow them behind the boat. This is actually the same technology that's used in exploration for oil in the water. And with that case, what you do is you set off what's called a seismic event, which is, in the layman's land, is we're setting off dynamite. So we set off an explosion. We look to see when the signal arrives at an array of hydrophones that are dragged behind the boat. And from that, we then try to figure out what the composition is below the water surface, you know, in the solid. This technology has been used for many, many years. In fact, 30 years ago, I worked for Schlumberger, the oil exploration company, and that's one of the things we were doing. We were actually using the same physics as we're talking about today for doing oil exploration.
We are we're talking to Professor Duncan Moore, and I found the name of this. You called it a submersible. What was the name? Tell me, is that right?
Yes.
And how would you describe a submersible?
Anything that goes below the water.
but I think of it as a drone or an unmanned.
It's unmanned, yes.
Unmanned, okay. So probably not a very big object, I assume.
It looks to be, I saw it on TV, it looks to be about 4 or 5 feet long.
Okay, and reading in multiple sources, USA Today and others, they called it an autonomous underwater vehicle, the Bluefin 21. There
right.
we go. That's the name of the submersible.
It's a drone. If you think about drones in the air, it's equivalent to doing it in the water.
Okay, so Bluefin 21 returned to the surface according to the Joint Agency Coordination Center in Perth, Australia. It should have taken the probe and its operators 24 hours to map the first portion of the search area. 24 hours just to map the first portion, which is 5 kilometers by 8 kilometers.
All right.
I did not look up just how much search area there is at the floor of the Indian Ocean.
It's a lot more than that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
24 hours to do 5 kilometers by 8 kilometers, which is basically 3 by 5 miles.
Right. And because they can do 15 square miles a day. Although yesterday's, they had to abort, and they didn't do the full 24 hours. But when the thing is running, they'll do about 15 kilometers a day, because square miles per day.
And they're saying that it could be days, weeks, or months for the Bluefin to really get a good, complete picture of this huge area, and that it may not find anything. And they haven't heard any other detections. So the Australian chief coordinator, search coordinator, Angus Houston, said, quote, "We haven't had a single detection in 6 days, so it's time to go underwater." I guess that what that could mean, Professor Moore, is that whatever was sending the signals is no longer functional, right?
Yeah, I mean.
You might just be not hitting them, right? Might be hearing it.
It could be that it's not hitting them, but the point is that we're now, 39 days out? And you think about, they talked about the batteries dying in a month. Batteries don't die in a month. They just gradually lose the power. It's like your flashlights. You get a little bit of signal out of it, the last day. Mm-hmm. It's kind of orange, the last thing. But, it's a gradual thing, and it may be that we're certainly beyond the specifications. And most things that are designed this will go beyond the specifications, and we've seen that in other technology.
I was going to grab Jeff in Rochester. We lost the call. Jeff, if you're there, you can go ahead and call back. We have a couple of questions and comments on Twitter, at Evan Dawson on Twitter, and asking essentially because you've advised a White House before, even if you weren't meeting directly with President Clinton, you had to do some advising. If you had to advise search teams here, I mean, is there any way to know where to start a search like this? What would you advise them, Professor Moore?
Well, I mean, I think they've done as good a job as they could considering the circumstances. I mean, I'm not sure they brought in all the best assets at the beginning. There was a lot of confusion. Remember this thing started with there was 2 Iranian students on the plane. They thought, they hijacked them. Well, that turned out to be completely false. And so, this whole issue in crisis management about how you get the right people in the location at the right time in a fairly remote area when you have no data. I mean, first approximately had no data. I mean, we're picking up today that the co-pilot's cell phone was on. And so they got
What's the significance there?
Well, that means they were able to detect when he was over someplace over Malaysia from one of the towers 30 minutes after they had done the turn. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. And that's another CNN issue, and I don't know. I won't go any further.
but I think the point we're making here is that there's been so many sort of false leads and false starts.
Mm-hmm.
Should we care if a cell phone was on? I mean, how much can you track that?
No, it's just one more data point.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You look at the TWA 800 flight that went out of Kennedy Airport that blew up coming out of the airport. And you look at how long it took us to actually figure out what the problem was. And that was in rather shallow water. It was all U.S.-led, so we were using the best technologies available. And I've forgotten how many years it took us to actually figure out that it was a wiring problem inside of one of the tanks that was not filled. And it was the spark hit,
and ignited the vapor in the tank and blew the whole thing up. And there were talks at the beginning of that one. It was a missile. People claimed they saw a missile, you know.
Right.
That turned out to be completely false.
Yeah, those initial accounts are just can be so misleading. On Twitter, Janine wants to know if a pinging sound could be anything else but the plane. We kind of talked about that, but how would you address that?
Yeah, what I understand is I think it's more than 95% man-made. That there are no natural sounds like whales and other fishes that would make that sound at that frequency, at that repetition. So I think it's that probably now we're up 35 days. That's probably pretty accurate.
And Gary wants to know if the plane could be so deep in the water that its sounds would be undetectable.
Sure. I mean, we don't know what, it's possible. And we don't know what the bottom is at that area. You know, if it's got a lot of silt on it. It could be buried in the silt.
I was just reading that silt could be a challenge. Explain that.
Well, it's like being in mud. I mean, you just think about if the characteristic of these submersibles that are trying to get to find it, they're sending out a signal and getting a reflection back. So they're not relying on anything on the plane to emit any light or sound or anything like that. So it's all in the submersible. So imagine you're trying to, you've got a laser beam. And you're trying to detect something that's buried in mud. That's going to be really hard to do.
How about just how deep it goes? I mean, 3 miles is what we're assuming right now.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things they're doing, of course. What they're doing is they're getting the data that tells us what the topography is.
Yeah.
That allows us to figure out, okay, what is the bottom made out of? I mean, the good news in all of this is we're going to get a lot of data about a part of the ocean that we knew nothing about before we started this.
Well, that's an important part of the question. We got a few more minutes with Professor Duncan Moore from the University of Rochester. He's a professor of optical engineering. 263-WXXI, 263-9994, or on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. Do we need, you said this, the surface of the moon we know more about than the surface of the floor of the Indian Ocean. How are we going to change that? Well, and should it be a priority to change it?
Well, I personally think so. I mean, I just think that there's so much in the ocean in terms of natural resources that we know nothing about. There's a tremendous amount of energy that's available in the ocean. Methane hydrides is an interesting problem off the coast of North Carolina. There's a huge energy source there. We've never figured out how to get that out safely. And that's going to be an interesting problem because it's coupled with the whole climate change issue and the warming of the planet, which is causing the ocean levels to rise, which is changing the pressure above the methane hydrides, and there's a very complicated set of things going on here. The resources of minerals in the deep water, rare earths aren't just in the earth, they're in the water too. And so some of the issues we have, the geopolitical issues we have with some of these rare materials, if we knew a lot more about the bottom of the ocean and knew how to mine them, I mean, there's a lot of stuff here. First is get data, then do the mining.
Let's get Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom. Thanks for calling Connections.
Hi. I just had a little question here. I was always under the assumption that sound traveled through the water. Like if you bang a pipe, it whales can sing for miles and miles and miles and miles. And if it goes through metal and it goes through water, why a silt on top of the pinger would disrupt that?
Well, it would absorb it. And so it'd be kind of like putting a laser beam through milk.
Well, the laser beam is light, and I understand a ray is a ray.
Right.
Or a wave is a wave, what I meant to say.
Well, yeah, so rays and waves are just different mathematical representations that are perpendicular to one another. So you normally think about waves when you say you drop a rock in the water and you watch the wave propagate out from the source. If we were to construct the rays, those would be perpendicular to those waves, and those would be in straight lines. So that's why I refer to this. That's why it's easier to think about it in a ray space than a wave space in this case. But they're mathematically
okay, but because they're obviously light and sound are they're both waves. But I just like with the whales going for. Literally miles and miles and miles and miles, and you hit a pipe, and it could be a long, long ways away, and that the sound waves carry through the pipe. And I was wondering how the silt dampens it. I would think that it would, it would be not necessarily an amplifier, that it wouldn't have that much effect.
Well, it depends a lot. For example, this is not something you should do at home, but if you put your ear on a railroad track, you can hear. If you put your ear to a railroad track, you can hear the sound of a train a real long way away.
No, I used to live right next to the B&O when I did it when I was a kid. You can hear it miles away.
Right. Yeah. That's why I'm not recommending it to at home. But the good news is you're going to hear it way before the train gets there.
Right.
But it depends. I mean, the properties of light and sound depend a lot on what media it's going through. We have a nice solid material like steel.
Right.
Nothing's going to slow that down. I mean, it's just going to go and go and go.
That was the thing. Because I know the whales is miles and miles, but I was just wondering how the silt or sand or whatever would dampen it, because I just was trying to figure it out in my head.
Well, it's going to scatter it is the correct way to think of it. It's scattering like scattering light off ground glass. A shower glass or things of that sort. Light doesn't go straight through there. And so if you're trying to measure the signal on the other side of a ground glass, and you say you take a laser pointer in, the signal is going to be significantly reduced on the other side of the ground glass.
We're talking to Professor Duncan Moore from the University of Rochester, an optical engineering professor, talking about why they're having so much trouble finding the missing Malaysian airliner that's they assume in the South Indian Ocean. And after getting four different pings, Lisa on Twitter wants to know, Professor Moore, how many boats are searching for the pings?
I have no idea. I know many countries are contributing resources to this, and planes and boats, and I don't know the answer to that question.
It's been a few days since they heard any of the pings, and they may not hear any more. For a number of reasons. Jake wants to know, do sound and light travel differently through water?
Yes, they do, because they use different properties. The density of the water is much more relevant to the propagation of sound. When you come to light, there are other details that come into it. So it's not obvious, but it turns out the rays of light would go in the opposite direction than the rays of sound.
Opposite directions.
Yeah, so if one goes to the left, the other will go to the right. But I don't want to get into that.
Another discussion for another day. All right, well, let's start to wrap up this discussion here with a couple of points. And if you're just joining us here, Professor Moore is helping illustrate, and I say illustrate, he brought some props to the studio. since you can't see that and you're listening to the radio, you can check out on rochester.edu. You've put up there, what have you put up on rochester.edu?
So we put up the demonstration I just gave you with a laser beam through this plastic box. We showed the video, we have a diagram of the water propagation up there also that shows that when you're further away from the source of the sound, you can get a signal, and then as you get closer, you don't. We have got some nice pictures of mirages that show the images of the sky or of the object upside down. Because one of the things I didn't mention, if the next time you see this, stop your car, don't do it while you're driving, pull over to the side of the road, and wait for an automobile to either go into the wet pavement or come out of it, mm-hmm. and what you'll see is an inverted image of that object in the road surface. And what's really cool is to do it at the airport. Then if you got a nice mirage, you can see an inverted image of the airplane either landing or taking off. And so it's something, get your telephoto camera, get a good zoom lens, and you'll get some good pics.
And I also want you to describe, because in case our listeners do check out rochester.edu and see some of these images, what is a gradient index prism?
Okay. I avoid trying to use those words.
No, that's okay. The host has asked for it, and my first day, this is a true story, Professor Moore, my first day, I had a caller call and say, will you trust us to want to digest interesting science? And I said, I will trust you. So this is the one time you can break the rules and tell us what a gradient index prism is here.
All right. So gradient refers to a change. Okay, a change. And in this case, it's the index of refraction. And index refraction is a property that measures the velocity of light in a material relative to in a vacuum. And so we
it's given index refraction. So it's the velocity of light divided by the index in the material. So it's a number greater than one, since all materials slow it down. I know there's probably some physicists out there who will disagree with me, and he'd be right because there are these new metamaterials. And but I'm using the classic definition, and so I don't want my colleagues to get all over my face at the faculty club. And so the so gradient index refers to change of composition. And so my research area has been for 40 years of propagation of light in materials in which the light does not go in a straight line. And so these curved paths. And so the block that I showed you and the prism in that case, because the properties change with wavelength, as you see in that particular one, it bends more in the blue than it does the red. So at the end of that block, which again, that one was about 4 inches long also, we had spread the light out about 5 millimeters in transversely. Then we took another prism, or another slab of this material, flipped it over. And so now I took it and brought the colors back together to form white light again. This is exactly the same experiment that Newton did in the 17th century. We took a regular prism that you're familiar with. He split apart the light, showed it was it had colors in it, took another prism, and brought them back together to form white light.
See? We can handle it here.
You can indeed.
Last takeaway I have for you is this. It does seem to me that what you're telling us about the bending of the sound and the way it travels through water, it's going to take tremendous good luck. If assuming the plane is at the bottom of the Indian Ocean, it's going to take tremendous good luck to find it.
Well, I would prefer to say it's going to take time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a matter of we're really lucky, we'll do it the next day. Okay? But it might be another year. And we just don't know. And so, and the good news is, unlike what the Titanic, you know, the technology we've got today is a lot better than it was then, clearly. It's a lot better than when the Air France one went down. So there will be better solutions, and people, this will become something that people, a group of people will be get very excited about trying to solve this problem. And so you'll get some of the best scientific and engineering minds working to solve the problem.
It does sometimes, a tragedy does force us to consider what we do know, what we don't know, and to learn a little bit, right?
Yeah. In fact, today the government announced they're going to have require GPS on all planes by 2020, which is really kind of interesting. They could have done that earlier, but...
Yeah. Professor Duncan Moore, thank you for taking the time to come in and join us on Connections.
My pleasure.
Rochester.edu to see everything he's been telling you about. We're going to take a very short break. Today's registration day. There's a deadline for the SAFE Act. And what's the status on assault weapons in New York State? We get an update on that, and you can weigh in if you want as well on this deadline day. I'm Evan Dawson, and you're listening to Member-Supported Public Radio. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to welcome to the program Leah Gunn Barrett, who is with New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. We're getting an update now on a deadline day. Leah, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
And a couple of important points to point out for our listeners here. Leah was on the program last week. Last Thursday, we had Assemblyman Bill Nojay on the program. He spent most of the hour talking about the SAFE Act, his opposition to it, his concerns that it's a violation of civil rights. And Leah Gunn Barrett joined that discussion. We did have some listeners tell us they thought it was unfair that she wasn't on for the duration of the hour. And Leah, we're glad to check back in with you and do our best to understand what's happening today. What's going on today with the SAFE Act?
Well, today is at midnight tonight is the deadline that owners of assault weapons who had these weapons prior to the passage of the SAFE Act on January 15th, 2013, must register them with the New York State Police. So they're allowed to keep them as long as they register them. And the process is simple, cheap, costs nothing, in fact, and painless. You can go online and do it electronically. And so that's all it is. So I don't understand what all the fuss is about.
Assemblyman Nojay told us back in February, and he reiterated it last week, that he thought fewer than 10% of the weapons that were supposed to be registered by today would be registered. And he said that is a perfect example of the fact that the people affected by the SAFE Act are not complying and have no interest in doing so and feel that their rights are being violated. Is he right? What are we seeing in terms of actual registration?
Well, I don't know where Nojay gets his information, 10%. Maybe that's just a wild stab in the dark. The fact is that the New York State Police are collecting this information. They're not revealing any numbers. We think they should. It's just numbers. It's not names, after all. And I would expect that the law-abiding gun owners in the state of New York and many people in the gun lobby claim that they're law-abiding, would follow a law that, after all, has been passed by a bipartisan state legislature. It's supported by a wide majority of New Yorkers and has been ruled constitutional by both federal and state courts, despite very vigorous efforts by the corporate gun lobby to block it.
We're talking to Leah Gunn Barrett from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Leah, by now you are tired of this question, but just clarify for our listeners that your name has nothing to do with the organization.
No, it doesn't. Gun is with two N's, and it's a Scottish clan, the Highland clan.
Ah, very good. Okay. And so we saw this past weekend, the Democrat and Chronicle covered the SAFE Act extensively. And the reporter wrote the story, Dave Andriotta, interviewed a number of gun owners in upstate New York who said that they feel like registration equals confiscation, that registering by today's deadline is the same as giving the state a pass to eventually come take their weapons. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, we register our cars. Has anyone's car been confiscated? I mean, a lot of things in life that we register. If you think about it, guns are deadly weapons, assault weapons even more so. They're designed for combat use. They were designed by the military to kill as many people as quickly as possible. Each of the banned features in the assault weapons ban has a specific military function. We're told by experts who know guns, who understand guns, that these design features that exist on civilian military-style assault weapons make these weapons as deadly as they are. These are not cosmetic features. They're what distinguish assault weapons from traditional sporting rifles. You don't go hunting usually with an AR-15 assault rifle. If you do, you're probably not a very good shot. These are weapons of war. They have no place in our communities. And registering them is, again, it's a very mild measure. And there's so many things in life that we register that have not been confiscated. So, again, it's a case, I believe, of more hyperbole and hysteria fostered by the corporate gun lobby.
But if the government is not going to take them away, why do they need to be registered?
Well, in case somebody, what if one is stolen or lost or ends up in the wrong hands? You need to be able to trace these weapons. They're very, very deadly. Why do we register our cars? You know, you could ask the same question of a lot of things that we have to register in life.
We're talking to Leah Gunn Barrett from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Today, a registration deadline day under the SAFE Act. And Leah, do you think the state police will eventually share with us the registration details?
Yeah, no, I think it will eventually come out, absolutely. The fact remains that this is the law of the state of New York. It's widely popular. It's going to protect people from gun violence. In fact, the data show that it's already working. Deaths by gunfire are down 2013 over 2012 by 4.5%. Probably the most important part of the law is the provision requiring universal background checks on gun sales. That, to me, is going to keep guns out of the wrong hands more than any other aspect of this law, because let's face it, most gun deaths and injuries are caused by handguns. And we have evidence that background checks work extremely well. Missouri repealed a state law that required background checks on unlicensed gun sales in 2007, and a study was done by Johns Hopkins on what happened between 2008 and 2012 in the state of Missouri. They found that gun murder death rates went up 23%. That was an additional 55 to 65 deaths due to gun violence each year. So we know that background checks work. They keep guns out of the wrong hands, which is why Congress needs to do what they should be doing and should have done long ago, is pass background checks at the federal level to keep all Americans safe.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. Leah, true or false, most gun deaths are by handguns?
That's true.
And so we're talking about assault rifles here, and a lot of the defenders say, number one, as Mr. Nojay said, the assemblyman who was on this program last week, he said assault rifles are for sporting purposes.
The gun industry would like for you to believe that. In fact, they've rebranded them modern sporting rifles. Look, these are weapons of war. They were designed by the military. The AR-15 is identical to the M16 rifle carried by our Marines and our armed forces. The only difference is it's semi-automatic rather than automatic. You can even argue that semi-automatic guns are even more deadly than fully automatic because you can actually control where you're firing more easily than if it's on automatic mode. So come on, these are weapons that even Justice Scalia, the Supreme Court justice, the most conservative member of the Supreme Court, believes should be regulated and are fully compatible with the Second Amendment. So if you've got Justice Scalia saying that we should regulate them, then, you know, what else can I say?
When we spent the better part of an hour on this program on the SAFE Act last week, we had a huge amount of interest, not only from our listeners by phone, but online, and I had a few questions from gun rights advocates. They told me that they feel that this is just a step toward, you know, like they said, registration equals confiscation. But they said, look, most gun deaths are by handguns. And the gun safety advocates know it. They're going after assault rifles because you have to start there, even though most gun deaths are by handguns. And that eventually they will get to handguns and they'll start registering and eventually banning handguns. What do you think about that?
Well, again, this is just an example of the corporate gun lobby using its scaremongering, fearmongering tactics yet again. Look, we've had, since 1911 in New York State, we have had the Sullivan Act. And you know what the Sullivan Act requires? It requires licenses for New Yorkers to possess firearms small enough to be concealed. And possession of such firearms without a license in New York is a misdemeanor, and carrying them is a felony. So we've had gun laws for over 100 years. Of this ilk, and no one has had any guns confiscated. People have had to have pistol licenses in New York for years now. None of these have been confiscated, except for very good reason. I mean, if the gun was going to be used in a crime or was used in a crime or there was some other reason, a domestic abuser possessed it. So, again, these are fear-mongering, scaremongering tactics that the gun industry loves to use. And regarding assault weapons, one in five police officers killed on the line of duty has been killed with an assault weapon. So they do kill people. And plus, we've seen them being used in Newtown, and Oak Creek and Aurora and many other places where we've had mass shootings. So yes, they kill people, not as many as handguns, but they are weapons of war, and when they are used, they have devastating results, which we've seen.
Ben in Pittsford, you're on Connections. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, so she's saying that there's not going to be any confiscation with this new law, but in the bill it says that when you die, you cannot pass down the hand or the assault weapons to your children, therefore they will be confiscated by the state. Also, she's saying that assault weapons are more deadly, but can you have her define an assault weapon for me, please?
Yeah, Ben, don't hang up. Stay there. Go ahead. Let's take the first point. When you die, your assault rifle cannot be handed down.
Well, when you're dead, technically you can't hand anything down, can you?
Right, but that's being confiscated from my family, is it not? If I want to leave it in my will and I can't?
Well, you want to leave an assault rifle in your will?
I want to. I can't, so it's being confiscated, correct? So there is confiscation down the road.
Well,
can you say there's not?
That is a very, very narrow example. Otherwise,
everybody dies, right?
If you register your assault rifle today, by midnight today, you can keep it, okay?
That's not true.
For your entire life. Yes, you can.
I can keep it for my life,
yeah.
But now who's to say they pass another law in 5 years and now they have everyone's name who owns them and they want to, it happened in New York City. Do they not confiscate from at least 20,000 people in New York City who registered their weapons?
You don't have that many assault weapons in New York City.
They weren't just confiscating assault weapons. They redefined illegal firearms in New York City because all firearms have to be registered with the city. So anything, even tubular-fed 22 lever-action rifles are being confiscated, and there are the confiscation letters online proving that it's true. So right there in our own state, we have proof that confiscation is taking place, but you're ensuring me that it'll never happen, even though we know it's definitely going to happen because I can't give it
law,
to my children.
As long as you comply with the law, then your weapon will not be confiscated.
Okay, okay, but let's okay. So you want to say that? So
well, that's true.
I was complying with the law prior to the SAFE Act, and now I'm not.
Yeah, but the SAFE Act changed. Is the law. So by definition, you comply with a law that's
exactly.
been in effect for 15
exactly.
months.
Exactly. But what I'm saying
is
last
the law
year,
of New York State.
But listen, last year I was complying with the law. This year I'm not complying with the law by not registering. So who's to say next
but
year if I don't turn
passed.
In my...
Wait, laws
but
are
who's
passed
to
all
say,
the time.
Who's so, to say next year they don't ban assault weapons completely and I have to turn it in. Now I'm not complying with the law again. Laws change every day.
Yes, hold on a sec. Hold on a sec. Ben, this has always sort of been, to me, the weakest part of the argument that you used to be law-abiding and now you're not because laws change. I mean, the law used to allow segregation, and you used to be allowed to do that. And if you own a restaurant or whatever and you say, hey, last year I wasn't violating the law when I wouldn't let black people eat here, and now I apparently am, and that's unfair because you just turned me into a lawbreaker. That's a
right.
weak, isn't that a weak argument?
Not really, because... The firearms are protected by the Second Amendment, right?
No, well, listen, even did
Hold
you hear what I said earlier? The Supreme
not,
Court
I
has
get
said the Second
points,
Amendment
though.
Is fully compatible with regulating dangerous weapons.
Okay, hold on, Leah. And Ben, let's...
I got one more point to
yeah,
make
go, go ahead, go ahead.
So you're afraid of these assault weapons are defined by features, correct? So have
yeah,
you looked
are.
Into the
they
new
were designed
New York
by
State?
The military. Each of these features has a specific military function.
That's not true.
It is true. You check with any person in law enforcement. Check with the New York State Police. Ask anyone who understands these guns very well, and they will tell you that each of these
but
features has a specific
have you ever, have you ever,
why,
have you ever in your life looked up
why else are people so upset if they're banned? Why else are people so upset? Because they know that these features actually have military purpose.
All right, Ben, go ahead.
Have you ever looked up the definition of an assault weapon?
Many times.
What's it say?
It's actually in the New York SAFE Act. I refer you to the SAFE Act.
They redefined
it. Very clearly
they redefined it.
Yeah, one
okay,
feature
so,
test.
All right,
so
Ben, can the host jump in here? Hold
one
on a second. Ben, hold on a second here. Let the host jump in and ask a question here. Because I do appreciate your concerns, and I appreciate Leah addressing the points as well here. And I do want everyone to have a voice here. But, Ben, we've had a lot of questions on all sides. We've had questions from people on your side saying, is this really about confiscation? We've had questions from people who choose not to own guns who say, I don't get why Ben wants to own an assault rifle. Can you tell me, Ben, you know, answer that question for our listeners who are not gun owners. Why do you want an assault rifle?
Assault rifles are perfect for women. I own one. My wife can shoot it no problem, way easier than a shotgun. They're very easy to use. Anyone can pick them up and use them well.
Isn't it a little sexist to think women can't handle weapons?
Have you ever seen a woman shoot a 12-gauge shotgun with no experience? Have you ever seen a woman shoot an AR-15?
Ben,
with no
I've
experience?
Seen women shoot
huge
all
difference.
Kinds of weapons.
There's a huge difference. Ask any woman between a 12-gauge shotgun with buckshot or a slug versus an AR-15.
Okay, okay. All right, so it's
have,
for women.
Now,
okay.
There's more. So now we have 10 rounds in the magazine, right? 10 rounds is better than any shotgun, unless it's a magazine-fed shotgun, which is already illegal. So, they classified assault weapons. My Ruger 10/22, I had a thumb hole target stock on it, and now it's considered an assault weapon. It's made for sporting target shooting, and now it's illegal. I have to take that stock off and put a standard Monte Carlo stock on the same gun, and then it's illegal. So I have the same gun, same function, same features, but I have to take the stock off to be compliant. How does that make anyone safer? It's the same exact action, same magazine, same everything, except for the stock. How are you safer?
Leah, go ahead.
Well, the thumb hole stock actually gives you control when you're shooting.
Right, which is good for turkey hunting and target shooting, right?
Turkey hunting?
Deer hunting?
I mean, I can go grocery shopping in a tank, but I choose not to. I mean, it's not exactly appropriate.
That was a totally ridiculous comparison versus a tank and a firearm.
If you look at the features
ridiculous.
In an assault weapon, that really functional design features, the most significant ones in an assault weapon are, first of all, the ability to accept a high-capacity ammunition magazine, a rear pistol or thumb hole grip, as you've just said, thumb hole stock, and a forward grip or a barrel shroud. So these three features taken together, these are the design features that make possible deadly and indiscriminate spray firing, the spray firing for which assault weapons are designed. And none of these are features of true hunting or sporting guns.
And I have to, and Ben, I want you to know, we're running out of time here, and I wanted to hear out all the points here. We don't take sides as a host here. We want to try to bring in all sides of the discussion. And so I appreciate that. Leah, I'm going to have to wrap with you in just a minute here, but I know Ben's concerns are represented by a lot of people in this state, aren't they?
Well, you know, if they're law-abiding, they will comply with the law. And if they really think the law is unfair, then they can have the law changed. We have a democratic process. We have procedures to do that.
And give me a sense for what New Yorkers Against Gun Violence want to see next. A lot of people said, hey, you've got the SAFE Act. You've been successful. What do you want to see next?
We need a law protecting children around guns, specifically safe storage of guns in the home, child access prevention law. 28 states in the District of Columbia have some form of a so-called cap law. New York State does not. We've named the bill Nicholas's bill after Nicholas Nomkin, a 12-year-old from Saratoga Springs, who was shot and killed while on a play date on the 23rd of December 2010.
Okay. 20 seconds. Paul in Buffalo, you got 20 seconds. Go.
The gentleman just before me had indicated that he has weapons and his wife. Could you address the weapon problem with women in the home?
Well, I think that, you know, women who live in homes with guns are more at risk for you know, being killed if it's a domestic violence issue. I think that, you know, guns in the home, it's been shown time and again by public health experts who study this issue, don't protect you. You're 22 times more likely, if there's a gun in the home, to use it either on yourself, someone you know or love, suicide, accidental shooting, than you are to repel a home invader. So those are just the facts.
Leah, the registration deadline is midnight. 30 seconds left here. Just recap it for our listeners who are just joining us.
Well, the ban on military-style assault weapons is an important part of the New York SAFE Act. We know that these weapons are deadly. They serve a specific military combat function. They really have no place in civil society, in our communities. And the New York SAFE Act, through measures such as universal background checks on gun and ammunition sales and tougher penalties for illegal gun use, amongst other measures, will protect communities all over our state. And that's one reason why New York has the fourth lowest gun death rate in the nation.
Well, Leah, I appreciate the time. If we get numbers from the state police, we'll talk about it again, because Bill Nojay, Assemblyman, and many others have said it's going to be very low registration numbers. You think it's not going to be that drastically low, but we're going to find out, and we'll continue to follow this. And thanks for spending a few minutes with us this afternoon, Leah.
Thank you.
That's Leah Gunn Barrett, New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. For our listeners, again, we don't choose the sides, and Ben is a perfect example. I know Ben was fired up, but I wanted to give him time. I'm not going to cut off callers. We want to have good conversations here and try to learn every single day here on Connections. Hope you've enjoyed this Tuesday afternoon. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll see you right back here on Wednesday on member-supported public radio.